was having to run up the street yesterday in sunglasses really quickly, trying to get to my class, you know, and not get arrested. It's ridiculous. And the green is the very center of our campus. We all, you know, we all cross it many times a day. My kids grew up playing on the green. The idea that we can't have access to the beating heart of our campus is offensive again. And, you know, just gives a sense. The president makes this argument that she's trying to ensure that the green is open to people with all views, and that, you know, the five tents and 10 students who were camped out there would make the green a place that only people of one view could be. Honestly, I think that's what they did by making making us frightened. I'm still hurting. I have nerve damage in my wrist. I have an injured shoulder. I have bruising and swelling, and it's very scary. And I'm getting better, but it's crazy that I should be in this position for trying to protect my students. And I say the same for other faculty who are out there, including Chris McEvitt, my colleague on the faculty, who was also arrested and also harmed.
Annalise Ehrlich, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College, where she's taught for more than 30 years. Professor Ehrlich, among dozens of students, faculty, community members arrested at a Dartmouth encampment. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and KBOO's spring membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and May 25th to support Avant-Garde Airwaves.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Portland police shot and killed a Portland resident of the Hazelwood neighborhood after serving a search warrant on Monday. Multnomah County sends out misprinted ballots to over 9,000 East County voters. And, in international news, researchers find new evidence showing that bumblebees cooperate to complete tasks. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland police shot and killed a man in the Hazelwood neighborhood of Portland on Monday evening. Police have not yet released many details about the shooting. Around 5:15 p.m. yesterday, cops were serving a search warrant on Southeast 124th. They say an unidentified man fired on the officers around 6:30, and cops returned fire, killing the man. Police found a gun near the man's body. Police say a medic was on the scene performing life-saving measures on the man, but he was declared dead at 6:38. No officers were injured, and all four of those directly involved will be placed on paid administrative leave. Portland Police Chief Bob Day told reporters, quote, "I'm grateful that our officers are going home safe tonight. These incidents highlight the risks our folks take every day," end quote. Hamas accepts a ceasefire deal amid warnings of a ground attack on Rafah by Israel, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejects the deal at the last minute. Some faculty members defend protesters as colleges cancel graduation ceremonies. And Bernie Sanders announces his re-election run. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We want to get these hostages out. We want to get a ceasefire in place for 6 weeks. We want to increase humanitarian assistance. And the last thing that I want to do is say anything at this podium that's going to put that process at risk.
At a White House briefing, National Security spokesman John Kirby would say little beyond confirming that Hamas has agreed to a ceasefire. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Joe Biden spoke by phone marking Monday's Holocaust Remembrance Day. Under U.S. pressure, Israel is letting more aid reach Gaza, but it also says it'll go ahead with a Rafah ground offensive. For the first time, the Biden administration has blocked shipment of ammunition to Israel, raising pressure on Netanyahu to accept a deal. Human rights groups have accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon. Cindy McCain, the widow of the late Senator John McCain and head of the World Food Program, says Gaza is now in famine.
There is famine, full-blown famine in the north, and it's moving its way south. What we're asking for and what we've continually asked for is a ceasefire and the ability to have safe and unfettered access to get into Gaza.
In a speech for the Holocaust Museum's Days of Remembrance, President Biden is expected to use the phrase never again and condemn anti-Semitism. A large number of University of Chicago faculty are defending a pro-Palestinian student encampment, saying it's peaceful and non-disruptive. Philosophy professor Anton Ford urges the school not to call in the police.
We support the protesters' central demands that the university divest its endowment and that it suspend its formal cooperation with Israeli institutions. We don't want them getting beat up just because they're camping on the lawn.
Many colleges have canceled graduation ceremonies, while others say they're reluctant to take commencement from students who missed their high school ceremonies due to the pandemic. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says for his part, Biden sees invitations to speak at graduations as a chance to address students directly.
To call for protests peacefully, and that's what we're going to continue to do, but we do feel for them. These are graduates who are going to miss out on an incredibly important day of commencement.
Former President Donald Trump has again been fined for violating the gag order in his hush money trial. Judge Juan Marchand fined Trump $1,000 for attacking the jury as full of Democrats. Marchand says another violation could lead to jail time. Progressive Vermont independent Bernie Sanders says he's running for re-election to his fourth term. Along with his concerns about rising wealth inequality, Sanders says he's running to defend American democracy during the most important election of our lives.
Will the United States continue to even function as a democracy, or will we move to an authoritarian form of government?
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Oregon's primary election is May 21st, and ballots have already been sent to voters' mailboxes across the state. But for some Multnomah County voters, they're going to need to wait for a replacement since one county measure didn't get printed on their ballots. Some 9,300 voters in East Multnomah County received ballots that didn't include Measure 26244. That's the Metro Regional Government measure that would authorize $380 million in bonds for the Oregon Zoo, including for improving facilities. New ballots for these voters will come with a letter explaining what to do with the faulty ballot. Only one ballot can be counted for each voter, so the elections office advises destroying or discarding their original ballot. Multnomah County Elections Office says they found out about the error on Thursday and were able to send out the replacements later in the day, Thursday and into Friday. Most of the voters affected by the misprint are concentrated in two precincts in Gresham, with the rest just south of the city. Voters who have questions can call Elections Office staff at 503-988-VOTE, or by visiting a voter service location. That includes Multnomah County Elections Building on 10th and Southeast Morrison in Portland, or the Voting Express Center at the Multnomah County East Building at 600 Northeast 8th Street in Gresham. Oregon's primary election date is May 21st. Ballots need to be postmarked or dropped off at an authorized ballot drop-off location by that date in order to be counted. Schools in Washington just celebrated School Lunch Hero Day, created by the School Nutrition Association. But as KABU reporter Birdie tells us, workers are seeking appreciation in the form of raises.
School districts around Washington and elsewhere may have celebrated School Lunch Hero Day on Friday, a salute to cafeteria workers, but food service employees are asking for more than just a pat on the back. They're asking for a wage that keeps up with inflation. Washington State has about 6,500 school food service workers who make the average full-time equivalent of just over $54,000 a year. Paul Busey-Bing is a kitchen manager at Pine Lake Middle School in Sammamish.
All the positions in the school district are important and everybody works hard, but students who don't have a proper meal aren't getting nutritious food, then they're not capable of participating to their fullest extent in their school day. So what we do is very important.
This year, lawmakers denied a request from Superintendent of Public Instruction Chris Rakedal to give paraeducators a $7 an hour pay raise. In his re-election campaign, he said he intends to seek a more broad-based increase for classified workers next year. Busey-Bing says the cost of living has gone up, and the relatively low wages are making it hard to find enough staff.
We go through the school year a lot of times understaffed, and we don't have substitutes or other people to fill in when people are sick or go on vacation, and a lot has to do with the pay wage, especially with the inflation.
Many school districts say they are strapped for funding and need more state resources in order to recruit and retain qualified workers. For KABU News and the Public News Service, I'm Birdie.
A new study shows that bumblebees are more sentient and cooperative than scientists first believed. Researchers in Finland have come out with new information regarding teamwork in groups of bumblebees this month. Scientists trained a group of bumblebees to work in pairs to push blocks, both styrofoam and Legos. Another group was given the same task, but each bumblebee had to do it alone. Amazingly, the bees that were working together appeared to prefer waiting until their co-workers show up to help push the block. The scientists say more research is needed to find out exactly what bumblebees pay attention to in cooperative tasks and how much they understand their partner's role. Olli Lukola is a behavioral ecologist at the University of Oulu in Finland and lead author of the study. He said in a recent interview, quote, "We're surprised by how the bumblebees took into account their partners' movements when coordinating their own movements in tasks, demonstrating astonishing social intelligence. Their cooperation is socially influenced and may be actively coordinated, meaning they might understand their partner's role in cooperation," end quote. James Dory is a biologist in Australia who believes it is possible to train bees to a variety of cues, including visual, scent, and sound. He was not involved with the study, but expressed excitement about understanding bumblebee behavior. For example, scientists could apply the new information in agricultural settings to encourage bees to visit and pollinate certain crops. Dory said, quote, "The research shows that complex cooperative behavior from social insects can go beyond innate or hardwired actions, and that the bees are even capable of learning behaviors typically associated with animals like primates and dolphins." Gold medal-holding athlete Jim Thorpe was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Biden last week, some 70 years after his death. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Athletic great Jim Thorpe has been awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom posthumously. The Presidential Medal of Freedom is the nation's highest civilian honor presented to individuals who have made exemplary contributions to the prosperity or security of the United States, world peace, or other significant societal, public, or private endeavors. James Francis Thorpe was an American athlete and Olympic gold medalist and a member of the Sac and Fox Nation. Thorpe was the first Native American to win a gold medal for the United States in the Olympics. He won two Olympic gold medals in the 1912 Summer Olympics, and he was also a professional football, baseball, and basketball player. He died in 1953 at the age of 65. Among the recipients were former Vice President and United States Senator Al Gore and Opal Lee, an educator and activist known for her efforts to make Juneteenth a federally recognized holiday. The awards were announced at the White House last week. The Board of Trustees with the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, located in Juneau, Alaska, recently appointed a new member to help lead the nonprofit's programs. Tlingit Clinical Community Psychologist Anda June Alicia Marvin of Anchorage will fill the seat, which was recently vacated by longtime trustee Jean Brainig. Marvin said in a statement, quote, "I will be using my training and community work in psychology to contribute to the important work of SHI. I am honored to serve on the Board of Trustees as I find deep meaning in community service," end quote. Marvin belongs to the Raven Moiety Clan and the Whale House. SHI President Rosita World said she looks forward to Marvin's contributions and expressed gratitude for her service of Brainig, who is Haida and was recently elected to serve as president of the Kasan Village Corporation, Kavilko Incorporated. The Alaska Heritage Institute is a private nonprofit founded in 1980 to perpetuate and enhance Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian cultures of Southeast Alaska. The Sitka Tlingit Clan houses in Southeast Alaska was recently put on a list of the most endangered historic places in America. The National Trust for Historic Preservation revealed the Tlingit Clan houses on the 2024 list this week, an annual ranking that spotlights significant sites of American history that are at risk of destruction or irreparable damage. The list also includes the Hudson Athens Lighthouse in Athens, New York, Little Tokyo in Los Angeles, California, and the Cindy Walker House in Mexia, Texas. In a statement, President and CEO of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, Carol Quillen, said, quote, "This year's most endangered historic places list shows how our collective idea of American history has expanded in recent years, along with our ideas about which places are worth saving," end quote. The list of America's most endangered historic places debuted in 1988 and has proven to be a highly effective tool for shining a light on the nation's most endangered historic sites. Some tribal nations of the United States have long traditions of using wildland fire for a number of purposes, like subsistence, resource management, and ceremonial activities. A new paper tries to quantify the scale of such cultural burning in the ancestral territory of a Northern California tribe. Researchers worked in close collaboration with the members of the Karuk tribe and their Natural Resources Department. On roughly 650,000-acre swath of the Karuk ancestral territory, the authors found that nearly 7,000 fires burning some 15% of that acreage were set annually. Co-author Christopher Dunn is a professor at Oregon State University.
It really offers us a foundation of what could be, probably a foundation of what should be.
Among the many recommendations to address the wildfire crisis from a major federal commission's report last year was to dramatically increase the amount of beneficial fire, including cultural burning. I'm Jill Freitas.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with University of Arizona professor Pat Willerton about the possible conclusions to the Russia-Ukraine war. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, for the wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 67 degrees. Today in history, in 1986, Canadian Patrick Morrow becomes the first person to climb each of the seven summits, the highest mountain on each of the seven traditional continents. The quote of the day is from Bengali poet and thinker Rabindranath Tagore, born this day in 1861. He wrote, quote, "The truth comes as conqueror only because we have lost the art of receiving it as a guest." A new study looks at the significance and number of transgender teenagers impacted by six types of laws from the 2024 legislative session. Alex Gonzalez reports from Salt Lake City, where Utah has become the latest state to enact a bathroom ban.
A staggering 93% of transgender teens live in a state that has enacted or proposed legislation that would restrict their rights, according to a new report from the Williams Institute at UCLA's School of Law. Utah was the first state this year to enact a bathroom ban that has led to some confusion as school districts aim to come into compliance. Alana Redfield is one of the report's authors and says despite the law being what she terms more measured, as it may permit some to use the corresponding restroom under limited circumstances, it doesn't mean it's less harmful.
even the mere fact of someone of discrimination being debated, of laws being debated that might potentially result in a restriction of rights or of access to services, that can have mental health outcomes.
86% of transgender and non-binary youth say debates around anti-trans bills have negatively impacted their mental health, according to the Trevor Project. The Williams Institute report also found that some states with an existing law impacting access to bathrooms also had new or carried over bills pending in 2024 that could further limit access. Redfield says the constant uncertainty that LGBTQ people face on a daily basis is taxing and can have serious consequences. While Utah may also have a gender-affirming care ban and is currently having its transgender sports ban challenged in court due to provisions that are likely unconstitutional and violate Title IX, Redfield says she's pleased to see similar laws failing to pass, in many cases because of people-driven initiatives.
We see a lot of power in state governments, and we see this kind of inspiring example from reproductive rights around, well, Arizona is a great example of people power and access to reproductive care, but also Kansas, when you see that the attempts to ban gender-affirming care has not been successful, and also attempts to ban abortion have not been successful in Kansas.
Redfield says it's important to highlight that half of all transgender youths in the U.S. live in 14 states and the District of Columbia that have enacted SHIELD laws, which protect doctors and parents who have sought gender-affirming care for trans youth. She adds that almost 200,000 trans teens now live in states that have banned conversion therapy, one of which is Utah. For Utah News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Delaware is the latest state to consider legalizing medical aid in dying. Oregonians enacted the Death with Dignity Act in 1997. In Delaware, the proposed Medical Aid in Dying Bill, House Bill 140, has cleared the state house and heads to the Senate, potentially granting terminally ill patients autonomy over end-of-life choices. Farah Siddiqui has more.
Advocates supporting the legalization of medical aid in dying in Delaware are optimistic following a recent passage of HB 140 in the state house. It's now under consideration in the state Senate. If passed, this bill would allow terminally ill patients with less than 6 months to live to choose medical aid in dying as part of their advance directives. Judy Gavadas is a patient and an advocate. She explains the proposed law would give terminally ill patients the power to decide how they want to handle their end-of-life care.
This isn't just about me. It's about understanding that dying is a very vital part of life. And the legacy we leave has to do with beginnings and endings. And there's a beginning and ending to death, and then a beginning again.
Gavadas acknowledges the opposition from religious groups, stressing that legislation respects diverse beliefs while offering options for those who don't find solace in enduring pain. The Catholic Bishops of Maryland wrote in a statement, "Human life is created in the image and likeness of God, and therefore sacred." They also write that medical progress in pain management allows for enhanced comfort for the terminally ill and can improve the quality of the remainder of their lives. Kim Callinan with Compassion and Choices shares the stories of Heather Block and Ron Silviero, the two Delaware residents who advocated for the medical aid in dying law but died suffering without being able to access it. She says their stories demonstrate the urgency of passing the legislation, as there are real people behind the legislative inaction.
When you have legislation that benefits people and harms nobody, there's really no reason not to move forward. Our hope is that lawmakers can see the people behind this bill and recognize that the time is now to pass this legislation in Delaware.
Currently, medical aid in dying is legal in 10 U.S. states: Maine, New Jersey, Vermont, New Mexico, Montana, Colorado, Oregon, Washington, California, and Hawaii, as well as in Washington, D.C. For Delaware News Service, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
U.S. officials have long claimed that the standard for respecting human rights is the same for all governments, including democracies. But U.S. policy on India and Israel has disregarded that standard. Both those countries have moved into the authoritarian column, yet continue to receive full U.S. support. We now go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. India is hailed as the world's biggest democracy, and Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Yet both are led by authoritarian rulers who are far more interested in crushing opponents than in promoting democracy. This reality should be sobering for U.S. presidents who, whether Democrats or Republicans, have consistently given both countries full support, India as a bulwark against China and Israel as a deterrent against Iran. But the challenge comes when democracy is failing in India and Israel, and human rights are under severe attack. It is precisely in answer to that seeming dilemma that the U.S. falls short, because strategic interests almost invariably trump human rights. A quote from Secretary of State Antony Blinken on aid to Israel that I reported last week deserves repeating here. Quote, as we're looking at human rights and the condition of human rights around the world, we apply the same standard to everyone. That doesn't change whether the country in question is an adversary or competitor, a friend or an ally. He also said we can count on Israel to investigate its own violations. This is what separates democracies from other countries, he said. The ability, the willingness, the determination to look at themselves. To state the obvious, first, the U.S. doesn't apply the same standard to everyone, and second, Israel and India and many others as well don't investigate their violations of human rights. If Blinken were honest, which might not be possible in his job, he would acknowledge the long-standing U.S. double standard when it comes to repression of human rights and other liberties in other countries. No mystery here. The U.S. condemns repression in countries with which it has an adversarial relationship, such as China, Russia, North Korea, Venezuela, and Cuba. And it ignores repression in friendly countries, such as India and Israel, which have value in the conduct of U.S. foreign policy. When governments change from adversary to friend, the U.S. lifts its concerns about their behavior. For example, when the Philippines leadership went from Rodrigo Duterte's violent war on drugs and friendliness to China to Ferdinand Marcos Jr.'s reaffirmation of the alliance with the U.S. And when governments do the opposite, moving from friendly to unfriendly, the U.S. suddenly becomes very critical of their repressive politics, as has happened with Turkey, Chile, Vietnam, among others. Moreover, the notion that friendly democracies, such as India and Israel, have self-regulating mechanisms to correct rights violations and undemocratic practices is rather laughable. Prime Minister Narendra Modi in India is doing the reverse. His intelligence service has now assassinated two Sikh activists in the U.S. and Canada. He's preparing to maintain, if not widen, the huge lead his Hindu nationalist party has in parliament, and he's doubling down on repression of Muslims. Modi faces a disorganized opposition, partly his doing. As the Times reports, quote, Mr. Modi has been relentless in trying to split the opposing coalition, luring some members with incentives and bogging down others with investigations and jail sentences. Likewise in Israel, let's recall the so-called judicial reform that Netanyahu and the far right were pushing before the Hamas attack, a reform that would have emasculated judicial independence and created a true crisis of democracy. That matter, as well as Netanyahu's personal corruption, remains to be settled, a situation that he is trying to delay by embracing war over negotiations. He and his far-right cabinet show no respect for the human rights of Palestinians, instead rejecting any plan that might offer people in the occupied territories hope for reconstruction and a country of their own. So let's not talk about how democracies regulate themselves. Instead, we need to talk about what, if anything, the U.S. government might do when faced with a choice between supporting an illiberal partner and being faithful to democracy and human rights. Doing the right thing has to mean a lot more than hoping one's friends will reform. The U.S. provides all kinds of important assistance to Israel and India, billions of dollars in direct military and economic aid, military intelligence sharing, extensive trade and commercial relationships, and political support in international forums, such as not aligning with those countries now charging Israel with genocide in Gaza. Any one of these supports can become leverage if an administration chooses to use it. The horrific situation in Gaza clearly poses the challenge immediately. It has galvanized increasing numbers of Congress members to consider limiting or withholding military aid to Israel. Yet Biden and Congress just keep supplying Israel with weapons unconditionally, not only encouraging its war to continue and negotiations to stall, but also failing to adhere to U.S. and international humanitarian law governing deployment of weapons against civilian populations. Thus, instead of seeing democratic Israel correct its violations of human rights, as Secretary Blinken would have it, it's another democracy, the United States, that is complicit in the violations. No self-correction here, just following tradition. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Dave Rosenberg, and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Faraz Siddiqui, and Jill Freitas. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
Listeners, sponsored stations count on you, not Arbitron. So when you push their buttons, you get radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener-supported community radio, KBOO FM in Portland.
Journey through lush songs and soundscapes teeming with life during the Garden of the Heart. Each episode explores the ways that music carries our emotions. Explore the garden every second Friday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. The Garden of the Heart is a bilingual program in English and Spanish that offers a mix of music that spans multiple genres, languages, and styles. The host is Zoe Caruso.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.